You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 174A, by Rudolf Steiner, 12 lectures entitled Europe, Between East and West in Cosmic and Human History. This is Lecture 9, translated by Christiana Bryan, given on the 14th of February, 1918, in Munich. Before I move on to address the main subject of today's considerations, I have a heartfelt need to express, both personally and in the name of our shared enterprise, how pleased I am that in the space in which we are meeting today, here in Munich, we serve a common goal, common work, and intentions, which promise to be exceptionally blessed in their fulfillment, which have already begun, and of which we must believe that they are capable of sending vital impulses into the spiritual life of the present time. Now, moving on to the subject of our deliberations, I would not like to fail in taking this opportunity, particularly at this time, to mention those close to us who are taking a heartfelt interest in our anthroposophically oriented spiritual science during these times of humanity's hardest trials, and to reflect on the connection between the fact that from this point, early in the 20th century, this spiritual scientific movement has been trying to embed its stimuli into human evolution, to connect this with the other fact that present humanity, precisely through its other pursuits, has admittedly led humankind into many catastrophic events. Just how catastrophic is humanity's situation is beyond the sufficiently serious and concerned comprehension of large numbers of people. The wish to live without spirit is widely accepted. This implies living superficially, which in turn involves sleeping through events surrounding us and affecting us so incisively. It has to be said that people nowadays are extremely prone to sleeping through many events. It is a minority who seek an adequate idea of the difficulty and poignancy of present events. Most people living from one day to the next. And if one makes so bold as to speak of times that could come in future, people, often those very people on whom much depends, reject it in the strongest terms. If spiritual science is to achieve one thing among its many tasks, it will be to stir souls to be a bit more energetic, to encourage them to be slightly more wakeful, then it will have done something fundamentally important for our times. Spiritual scientific ideas demand greater exertion in thinking, greater intensity in feeling and sensing than do other conceptual areas, particularly than the ways of thought actually governing today. Most especially, it is not unimportant that you familiarize yourselves with the ideas garnered from spiritual science, which can both direct and lead you to an understanding of the present in its widest sense. Today I would like to take you through some fundamental ideas, upon which we can build at the next meeting of this branch. Ideas which are useful for the purpose of shining a light on some crucial facets of the present. Today I will start from more general thoughts, from ideas involving more of a personal human angle, but which, from a certain point of view, can offer us a basis for our later spiritual scientific considerations. Over the course of spiritual scientific considerations, it has to be emphasized again and again how our lives undergo changes of consciousness between birth or conception and death, by alternating between waking and sleeping. People know about sleeping and waking in broad terms. Their true, more delicate nuances can only be appreciated when brought before the soul by a spiritual scientific outlook. Normally, We think that we just sleep between falling asleep and waking up, and one is awake between waking up and falling asleep again. This is only the crudest understanding. In truth, the border we demarcate between sleeping and waking is a false one. The condition of dull consciousness, which in many respects is no real consciousness at all, and is one we undergo during sleep, extends into our daytime life, and we remain within it with a portion of our being, even between waking and falling asleep. Between waking and falling asleep, we are by no means awake with our entire being, but are only awake with part of it, while another part continues to sleep even when we consider ourselves awake. In one respect, we are permanently sleeping beings. We are only really awake in respect of our perceiving and imagining. In that we perceive the outer world through our senses, in that we see and hear and so on, we are awake during that seeing and hearing, in short, in our perceptions. In this we are completely awake. We are also awake, though to a lesser degree, in that we imagine. When we form thoughts, when concepts elapse within us, when memories are dredged up from the dark substrata of our souls, then we are awake in respect of the processes we are experiencing, that is, in relation to the processes of having perceived, of perception, and of imagining. You know, however, that our life of soul also contains feeling and willing apart from perceiving and imagining. Regarding feeling, we are not awake, even when we think ourselves to be. What we know of all that goes on in our feelings is no more than we know about dreaming while asleep. The degree and intensity of consciousness of which we are aware while feeling equals the degree and intensity of consciousness while we are dreaming. Just as dreams arise as images from unconscious soul depths, so do forces of feeling arise as feelings. We are no more wakeful in feeling than we are in dreaming, only that we bring dreams into our normal waking imaginative consciousness, and after sleep distinguish dream from waking in that we can remember the dream, whilst feeling is instantaneous. Feeling itself is dreamt by us, but we accompany our feeling with concepts. In conceptualizing, we are devoid of feeling, but regard feeling from the perspective of concepts, in the same way as we look at a dream after waking. It is just that in feeling we are doing this simultaneously, which is why we are not conscious of the fact that we retain in our consciousness only the concept of feeling. Feeling is down in dream regions, just as dreams themselves are. You can recognize will purely externally. Do you know what actually happens when you decide to take hold of a book and your hand then grasps it? Do you know what takes place between the concept you alone have in your consciousness, "I want to take hold of that book," and all the mysterious processes that unfold within your entire organism? We know what we think about willing, but for our normal consciousness, we know nothing about willing itself. Whilst we dream through feeling, we sleep away the actual content of willing. Inasmuch as we are perceptive beings who imagine, we are awake. Inasmuch as we feel and will during waking, we are actually dreaming and sleeping respectively. Thus, in feeling and willing does a state of sleep extend into our waking consciousness. We therefore need to say, the condition in which we exist between falling asleep and waking up in terms of our entire being also empowers us with regard to feeling and willing while we are awake. Through perceiving and imagining, we learn to recognize a world around us which we designate a physical sense world. Yet through feeling and willing, we do not learn to recognize the world in which we exist as feeling and willing beings. We are continually in a supra-sensible world. Our feeling and willing as regards their forces, originate in this extrasensory world, just as our perceiving and imagining originate in the physical sense world. We have no organs for feeling and willing, but for perceiving and conceptualizing, we do have organs. That some physiologists believe we have organs for feeling and willing, some more thoughtful physiologists do not, however, is only a result of not knowing what they are talking about, talking anyway about something they'd like to know a bit about and yet do not. What I have just described is by and large the state we legitimately inhabit between birth and death. We wake in terms of our perceiving and conceiving or imagining. We sleep in relation to our feeling and our willing. It is a different matter between death and a new birth. In a certain sense, it is the reverse. There we begin to awaken in our feeling and willing. And there our perceptions and imagination fall asleep, although sleep is a different condition in the world in which our souls then live. But from what I have just said, you will be able to appreciate that the so-called dead can almost only be distinguished from the so-called living, in that the so-called living sleep through that in which the so-called dead actually exist. Those supposedly alive sleep through the feeling and willing perpetually streaming through their being. The deceased exist within that very feeling and willing. It will not be hard for you to understand that, in the same world in which we exist as so-called living people, the dead are also present. We are separated from them in no other way than that we do not perceive the world in which they live and weave. Those beings who have died are continually around us, living and weaving, without entering into physical incarnation. We just do not perceive them. You only need to imagine a person asleep in a room. Objects surround them, yet they do not perceive them. That something is not perceived is no proof that it isn't there, and says absolutely nothing as to whether it is around us or not. In actual fact, as regards the realm of the dead, we are in the same position as we are in relation to physical beings when we are asleep. We live in the same world as do the dead, the same world in which the exalted beings of the higher hierarchies also exist. They are here among us, and it is only our means of perceiving that separates us from them. And yet the issue is such that human beings only perceive part of that reality, only conceive of a fragment of the reality in which they are actually living. Were they to encompass the whole reality, then their knowledge would obviously look quite different from the way it is presently configured. Within that knowing there would coexist not only the forces issuing from the realms of nature well known to us, but this knowledge would also encompass the forces of higher spiritual beings, as well as those from the realm of the so-called dead. For the large majority of today's humanity, this remains an outlandish prospect. For even greater numbers, especially for those who interest themselves in the evolution and onward progress of human life, it needs to become a subject infused with thoughtful reason. Because in times that still extend into the present, human beings have been led by relatively dark and unknown forces in relation to what they cannot perceive in their surroundings. This being led by dark and unknown forces, about which we will speak again in future branch meetings, has now largely ceased. Human beings now have to place themselves into conscious affiliation with forces issuing from realms that project into ours, realms in which the so-called dead also tarry, bringing to humankind a level of consciousness, a consciousness open to accepting what is true and real, instead of the fantastical inadequacies swirling about and shaping life so catastrophically, will not be without its difficulties. To this effect, I will mention just one point by way of introducing you to the subject. Amongst many a topic presented as, in quotes, scientific, are some historical themes. History, for instance, is taught and learned in schools. Yet what is this history? A science of history is, as the expert knows, not much older than a century. Whoever is familiar with older literature knows that what is now termed historical science or science of history is not much older. I don't intend to go into this further. However, what now constitutes history will be considered by people, established by people, with the same conceptions, with the same definitions, as those conventionally used in external life, with those same notions that can be used in observing nature. Yet nobody asks themselves whether it is appropriate to set about observing historical life in the same way as external nature is observed. It is clearly not applicable. For in the historical life of humanity reign stimuli that cannot be encompassed with the concepts we have in our waking consciousness. But whoever can really observe history knows that in history we are governed by such impulsions as are only accessible for normal consciousness in dream states, at most in a state of dreaming. What flows by as history is dreamed by humanity. In just the same way as humanity dreams away its life of feeling, does it likewise dream through what are historical forces of impetus? Should one wish to observe human historical life with the same conceptual tools as are well suited to observing nature, it cannot be captured. It only allows of being observed on a superficial level. What is being taught and learned in schools as history, it is no more related to real actual history than were you to describe a living human by demonstrating this on a corpse. Today's conventional history consists in observing corpses. History needs to be most radically transformed, and what actually holds sway in history will in future only be encompassed through inspiration, through inspired concepts. That will result in true history. Then you will know what holds sway in humanity, and you will also know what works into social life from out of history. What I am saying here is of profound importance. People think they understand socio-historical life. They do not understand it, because they only wish to conceive of it within the conventional conceptual parameters of their waking life. This is not apparent in written history, because there nothing much depends on it being correct. Many an obvious example would illustrate that very little depends on accuracy, and I will bring one such here. You will normally learn in conventional history books that America was discovered in 1492. That is the case. From what literature states, you educe that before that date, America was completely unknown, however far back you search. But that is not so. America was only unknown for a few centuries. In the 12th and 13th centuries, there was still lively traffic between Iceland, Ireland, and America. Particularly, remedial herbs and such like were traded into Europe. For reasons connected with the inner karma of Europe, and with the role Ireland had played in earlier ages, it turns out that Rome did everything possible to close Europe off from America and to render America forgotten. What took place at the instigation of Rome was not actually unfavorable to European relations. It was well-intentioned toward Europe. With this example, I just wish to show that a fact need not necessarily be an historical fact, that one can still remain quite ignorant of important historical matters. Now, on the other hand, whether you are historically knowledgeable or ignorant is important as regards the social and societal life of humanity in general. That is of moment. How often do we hear people today saying, "You need to think about this or that event in such and such a way because history teaches us this or that"? Just look at today's exoteric publications, and you will see how often the phrase crops up, "History teaches us this or that." People partially sleep through historical events they have experienced, yet they still form judgments or allow themselves to be inoculated with opinions about those events. You will frequently hear that phrase, "History teaches us." Men of consequence at the start of this war told us what history had taught them. It was at the time the honest conviction of seemingly clever people that this war would last at most 4 to 6 months, in line with general social and economic conditions across the globe. Many predicted that it would only last 4 to 6 months. This turned out exactly as did the other predictions of a far greater person who declared them historical prophecy. Yet these were only based on the ordinary concepts of ordinary consciousness, which cannot capture history, because history is usually slept through, which can at most be dreamt and only grasped within the widest terms of reference. Schiller, on taking up his Jena professorship, held his renowned speech on studying history. It dates to shortly before the outbreak of the French Revolution. Schiller, truly no insignificant figure, drawing on his deeply researched view, a view deeply researched only with ordinary historical concepts, says, not literally, but something along the lines of, "History teaches us that in days of yore there was much strife and warfare among people. From all that contributed to this we can deduce that in future Europeans may have disharmony among their number, if they will always feel themselves to be members of a large family, and will not therefore mutually tear each other to pieces." That, according to Friedrich Schiller. There followed the French Revolution, and all that overwhelmed the family of peoples in the 19th century, and all this demolished Schiller's so-called historical assessment. History will only teach us when we can penetrate it with inspired concepts. Because it is not only the living who play into humanity's historical life, but the souls of the so-called dead, the spirits, with whom the so-called dead live, much as we live with the beings of the animal, plant, and mineral kingdoms. Today, this is largely construed as a mere saying. But humanity will have to break radically from its habit of according no more verity to sayings than it presently does. We will only succeed in this once we have acquired concepts or ideas that are truly drenched in reality. One such particularly important idea is that which tells our awareness that we are separated from the so-called dead by nothing but our own consciousness. This consciousness, as regards the world in which the dead are around us, is sleep consciousness, as far as our feeling and willing are concerned, in just the same way as sleep consciousness relates to objects in our vicinity while we are asleep. Clairvoyant consciousness corroborates in every detail what I have just characterized more generally. The question might, however, arise, how can human beings know so little about the world in which they are immersed, the world through which they wander with every step they take? Well, you see, it is precisely the ways and means by which clairvoyant consciousness explains in concrete terms what we must call interrelating with the so-called dead, which form living proof of the fact that for everyday consciousness, the realm in which the dead live must initially remain unknown. I need only outline a few traits of such intercommunicating with the apparently dead, admittedly at a somewhat enhanced level of clairvoyance of sighted consciousness. And you will see why in normal life one knows nothing of the interchange with those who have died. It is entirely possible, though it can have dubious aspects, that people awaken their consciousness to a point where the realm of the dead is open to them, that they are able to perceive this realm of the so-called dead, and are in a position to, as it were, commune with departed individuals. In order to understand the dead reliably, they need to learn to behave quite differently in their consciousness. This needs to be quite different from that in everyday use in the physical world. Let me give you a couple of features. You see, when you communicate with another person in the physical world, you rely on certain habits. When I talk with someone, I am used when asking them questions or conveying something, to speaking, being conscious that speech issues from my soul via my organs of speech to the other person. I am conscious that I am speaking, conscious also as regards outer perception. In answering or telling me something, the words of the other person, here on the physical plane, resonate toward me. It is not like this in fully conscious converse with the dead, though in semi-conscious converse it again varies. It is the exact opposite. If I can express it thus, in a realm such as this, it differs completely from expectation. When I face a deceased person, they speak in their soul what I am asking or what I wish to tell them. I receive it as being said by the other. What they tell me sounds upward from my own soul. If the person can face their thoughts so objectively that they appear to swarm around them, the dead can understand those thoughts. People are connected with the dead in normal consciousness but are unaware of this because they are not in a position to discern the factual process just outlined. In order to gain insight into it, we need to focus on the fact that we have important states of consciousness other than sleeping, waking, and dreaming. We have two other extraordinarily vital states of consciousness, which we also ignore in normal life. We ignore them for a reason which will immediately make sense once I name them. We also experience the processes of falling asleep and waking up. They do not last long, but pass so swiftly that people do not notice them as to their content. At the very moments of falling asleep and waking up, the most important occurrences take place. If one learns to recognize their essential nature when falling asleep and awakening then, from a certain point of view, one is able to receive true ideas about the relationship of the human being with the world, a world in which the dead also exist alongside us. I said that human beings are continuously connected with the realm of the dead. This relationship is especially active at the moments of falling asleep and waking up. Clairvoyant sight confirms that the moment of falling asleep renders one particularly suited to asking questions of the deceased, to bringing them news, and so on. In short, turning to the dead. The moment of awakening equips one especially for receiving news and tidings from the dead. These tidings arrive swiftly, just before one is wide awake. What is so quickly delivered is immediately overlaid with tumultuous wakefulness. This was known and implicit among atavistic conditions and populations not so long ago, conditions that are being gradually lost to our materialistic culture, even among remoter ethnicities. Those having grown up among older people in remote agricultural areas know that a fundamental rule pertained, that one should remain quiet for a moment on waking up before looking out of brightly lit windows, because the lingering after echo of what was experienced in sleep was not to be drowned out by turbulent wakefulness. Indigenous folk appreciated lying for a spell in semi-darkness on waking instead of focusing on bright daylight. Something else comes into consideration, though it is not too difficult to perceive, that the moments of awaking and falling asleep contain something special. To be able to take proper note of such moments demands, if I may say, a certain alertness in thinking, a capacity which has never been in such short supplies now. Grotesque examples could be cited as to the present state of wakeful thought. Banal examples running throughout daily life can be found on every street corner. Here is one such banal example. A few days ago, my eye fell on an announcement about an eighth of a newspaper page in size. I saw that it was a widely distributed advertisement extolling a famous method of memory training, Pullman, something like that. Among myriad adverts, this one claimed that one could not gain influence over other people without taking advantage of the Pullman method. I am not now commenting on the legality, rights or wrongs, of gaining influence over other people. That doesn't concern us here. But I'm only referring to what the advertisement claimed. It continued in this vein. Some people claim, by cultivating their personal magnetism and by strengthening who knows what other attributes in the human arsenal, to exert influence over other people. It's easy to prove to such people that they are not telling the truth, because it only takes one person to come clean as to whether they have attained the personal wealth of a Rothschild, or that some other wealthy person has left them millions. As this has patently not happened, despite it having been tried, there is ample proof that this method does not make you capable of influencing others, because influence is only attained through science and education. Then the Pullman method is described. We know that a whole number of people will be convinced by it. Other chaps don't have the option to cultivate qualities that influence others, because it's quite clear, isn't it, that they have no such influence as compels, say, a Rothschild, to part with millions. Ask yourself, how many who read this advertisement will query, might Pullman really have so many students who have relieved millionaires of their cash? Just ask yourself, how many will make this thought association? That's a trivial example, but it shows how thought processes are not awake to what has been read. I chose it, firstly, because of its everyday character, and, secondly, because there are obviously none here present who would not have had the thought that Pullman himself did not succeed in making millions. Obviously, all those who were gullible enough to be taken in by the advertisement are elsewhere, and, out of politeness, I am not using an example into which those present might have fallen. What I do wish to say is that from morning till night people read assertions of this kind. They claim not to take any notice of them. They don't notice them. I once read in a speech a sentence like this, quote, "Our connection with a certain empire is the key that must in future give direction to our politics," close quote. Just imagine thinking constructed in this way. A connection is a key which will become a direction. Someone who thinks like this is in a position to take action and to do all manner of things in life. We just don't notice how many correlations there are between such stunted thinking and public life. Today we do need to respond to the non-wakefulness of thinking that is such a feature of our times, and to beware of this non-wakeful thinking. Executable thoughts are a first requirement for anyone wanting to be capable of taking note of the revelations at the moment of falling asleep and waking up. I once took part in a lecture by a very famous literary historian. It was his inauguration speech, and he had put much effort into it. He had formulated all manner of literary, historical questions, at the end of which he said, "So, ladies and gentlemen, I have led you into a forest of question marks." At the time, I imagined a forest of question marks. Just think, a forest of question marks. Whoever is used to putting into practice concepts formed within themselves, anyone developing wakefulness in their thinking, they alone are prepared to also notice moments such as those of awakening and falling asleep. What is not perceived is still present, though, including communion with the departed, which is particularly active at the moments of falling asleep and waking up. Basically, every person poses countless questions and conveys countless tidings to those loved ones who have died, also receiving messages and answers from the deceased at the moment of waking up. This communion with the dead can to some extent be cultivated. We have discussed various ways of nurturing this dialogue, but I'd like to say the following. There is a difference as to whether or not a thought, which has connected us with someone who has died, leads us to being able to turn to them when we fall asleep. It is a distinct difference. Anyone for whom life is not solely a matter of putting themselves first in an egotistical or sensual way, will, due to their healthy sensibilities, feel a need not to interrupt a conversation with people with whom karma has brought them into contact, and who may have gone through the gate of death either recently or longer ago. They will often join thoughts with such personalities. It is entirely possible that the thoughts we connect with an image of a departed individual may give rise to proper exchanges, even if we do not personally know them, even if we are not able to pay sufficient attention to the processes unfolding at the moment of falling asleep. Some thoughts are more favorable for such exchanges, others less auspicious. Abstract thoughts, thoughts containing a certain indifference, perhaps thoughts we harbor only out of a sense of duty, are less conducive to moving toward a person on falling asleep. By contrast, thoughts and concepts issuing from a feeling of an especial interest, or which may have associated us with the person during life, are well suited to linking with the deceased. Let us remember the dead in such a way that we think of them not just in abstract thoughts or cold concepts, but by calling up a moment in our souls when we are warmed at their side, when what they said was not just factual, but something lovely, dearly remembered. Let us think back to moments we spent with the deceased, when we shared in communal feelings and joint impulses of will. Let us remember when we undertook combined ventures or decided on something of value to us both, something that led to shared work. In short, whatever made our hearts chime in unison. Let us enliven and bring to life this harmony of hearts. And it will color thoughts of the departed such that these thoughts can stream across to them when we next fall asleep. Whether you have those thoughts at 9 o'clock, 12 o'clock, or 2 o'clock, the whole day offers us the time to have such thoughts. They remain, they persist, and flow across to the deceased at the moment of our falling asleep. At the moment of waking up, we may receive communications, news, or answers. These may not immediately surface in our souls at a time when we pay attention to them, but may arise throughout the course of the day, in the form of some inkling or notion, if we believe in such possibilities at all. Here again, some attitudes are more enabling than others, and the dead find certain conditions easier for speaking into our souls, so that it actually resounds in them. Other conditions are less favorable to this. Especially conducive are circumstances in which we have acquired a clear and strong image of the being of the deceased, generating lively interest in them, that their being arises in great reality before the eyes of our soul. You may ask, why is he saying that? If a person has been close to me, then of course I will have an impression of their being. My dear friends, I do not believe this to be so, especially nowadays. Today people pass each other by and know each other very, very little. This may not estrange you much here in the physical world. It does, however, estrange you greatly in the world which the dead are experiencing. You see, here and for this physical world, numerous unconscious or subconscious forces and impulsions bring human beings toward each other, even if they do not wish to get to know each other. It can happen in life, as some of you may have read, that one can have been married for decades and yet hardly have really got to know the other person. But there are other stimuli that bring people together, which do not depend on them being mutually acquainted. Life everywhere is saturated with unconscious and subconscious incitement. As just mentioned, these subconscious impactions bind us here, but they do not bind us to the beings who have gone ahead of us through death. For that we need to have really absorbed into our souls something whereby the other being can vitally dwell in us. The more spiritedly they can live in us, the more easily can they gain access to our souls, and the better can they make themselves understood to us. This is what I wanted to characterize for you about communion of the so-called living with the so-called dead, which endures and is ever and ever again present. Each one of us communicates endlessly with the dead, and just because we do not realize it is only a result of not being to a sufficient degree alert in observing the moments of falling asleep and waking up. I say this to give you more concrete contours to coexisting with the supra-sensible world in which the dead live. It will become all the more firmly concrete if we bring a few other circumstances into consideration. Young people are dying. Older people are dying. And yet the deaths of young people who pass on are, for those remaining behind, something different in nature when compared with the deaths of old people who expire. It is only really possible to talk about such issues if one is able to focus on individual concrete examples. What I am depicting definitely does not originate in general science, but I am just summarizing what has taken place in concrete individual instances. If one follows with visionary consciousness what happens when children leave their parents in death, when young people take leave of those to whom they belong and go through the gate of death, and when one learns to recognize how these souls live onward, then this knowledge presents itself in the following words, with which I wish to summarize it. One has to say, in the consciousness of those younger people who have traversed the portal of death, lives what can be outlined by saying, they are not actually lost to the living. They remain there. They stay in their vicinity. They endure within the very beings of those outliving them. As younger people, they are not separated from those left behind, but remain for long spells within their orbit, within their sphere. About older people dying, such as parents leaving their children, one has to say something different, something best said epigrammatically. Of older souls dying, it can be said that their souls do not, for their part, lose the souls of those they leave behind. So, while those left behind do not lose their younger, departed souls, the older people, having gone through the portal of death, do not lose their contact with the souls of those left behind, despite the latter remaining here. They, to some extent, draw with them what they want of us. They can more easily acquire everything from souls remaining here, something the younger souls can only obtain if they stay where they are. This is what younger souls do, remaining more or less within the sphere of those left behind. These relationships can be studied in a specific way, so that what I have just said can become a certainty. They need, of course, to be studied with visionary consciousness. With this seeing consciousness, one can observe the sorrow of mourning, the pain of separation. Grief and separation pain are actually two differing conditions. People don't know this, but if one observes the grief and pain over a departed child, it is quite different from the grief and pain observable over the death of an older person. Though people are unaware of this, they are two fundamentally differing states when determined within the soul as an inner condition. A remarkable aspect is this. When, let's say, parents mourn their early departed children, this is actually a grief, which, as far as its actual content and its deeper impetus are concerned, is only a reflex, a reflection of what the child remaining nearby radiates into the souls of those left behind. The child has lingered, and remaining nearby, it feels all manner of sensations, which percolate into the souls of those left behind, and there awaken a response. It is a pain of compassion, a feeling of shared pain in common, which is actually the pain or sorrow of the child itself. This is the pain one feels. One may naturally ascribe this pain to oneself, but it is a pain of co-empathy. You must not misunderstand me. We need to take these expressions sensibly and definitely, without any negative or extraneous connotations. one could say. When a younger loved one dies, one is beset with the pain of one's own soul life, if only obsessed to a normal degree, so that it does no harm. They live on in us, and what is interpreted as pain is their life continuing in us. It is another matter in relation to an older person who has departed from us. Pain is caused, but not now as a reflection of what lives in the deceased, because they can really receive upward what is in our soul. For their part, we are not lost to them. We cannot become obsessed with their pain, nor in any way beset by their feelings, because they have no longing to radiate into us what their feelings, and again, because they draw us along with them. They do not lose us. That is why this sort of mourning is an egotistical grief. That is not to apportion any blame, and is certainly justified, but we do need, quite fundamentally, to differentiate between these two sorts of grief. The matter becomes critical once one moves on to observe descriptions of pain or coexisting with the departed, as regards the deceased themselves. Given that the relationship with a younger person who has died is quite different from that with an older, departed person, it will be equally understandable that for the tending of remembrance and memories in relation to the departed in each of the two scenarios, it will have to differ. In relation to a young person, we will find the right service and memorial if we take account of the fact that the child or youth remains living with us, participating particularly in what we might have enabled the child to do had it remained here. Experience shows that what such children or youths particularly long for, in their hindsight memory, in all that we can bring toward them after their death, is to find universal human relationships. In the funeral service, too, this includes everything that offers more of generalized, universal focus than anything to do with specialized interests. For children and the early departed, the Catholic funeral service is more suitable, where rites are universal, where the service offers something to all in equal measure. A departed child longs for a ritual that is pan-human, one not especially for them individually, but one encompassing everyone. For an older person, a Protestant funeral service is preferable, one which goes into the life and specific circumstances of the deceased and includes a eulogy. If one wishes to care for their memory in remembrance of an older departed, it will be especially propitious to think about the details in their life, what was unique to them, all that was specific in their biography, and there to seek the thoughts with which one wants to celebrate the passing of one such older person. You see from this that, rightly viewed, spiritual science cannot remain mere theory. It can show us a great deal about world conditions and circumstances, from which we remain closed off only because we dream away our feelings and sleep through our impulses of will. Spiritual science speaks of worlds in which our feeling and willing are immersed. If we grasp spiritual scientific ideas with sufficient intensity and robust energy, they do not remain concepts, but work affectively upon feeling and willing. Just think how abundantly and effectively these spiritual scientific ideas can affect life. Priests performing funerals may find the right approach, the right insight, to lead these celebrations in a changed way, instead of adhering to mere abstract theology. All this is really no wonder, because the world of which spiritual science speaks is the real world, the genuine world, in which our feelings and our incentives of will live. So that what that world is able to bequeath in turn plays into feeling and willing. It radiates into our feelings, as into all else. When we, for instance, nurture our feelings toward those who have died. But the spiritual world also rays into our impulses of will, something that we ought especially to take into consideration today. For if you were to pursue the promptings of will that spur people today, you would not come up against any profound depths in the human soul. It is a peculiarity of our times that human beings need to find spiritual incentives for their will. That is also its tragic aspect, that so far there has been no decision to seek them. Salvation or redemption will only emerge out of present confusion and trouble if people evince a widespread will to seek spirit-inspired impetus for external life. As I have outlined this evening, this is still being rejected in the most widespread human circles. Yet they will have to learn about it, because this time, which has cut a swath through humankind itself, will be by far the greater teacher than it has hitherto been. Next Sunday morning, let us continue today's contribution, which explored some of the more personal aspects of the individual, and speak about present circumstances, but in an appropriately spiritual scientific way. The end of Lecture 9.